Live from Torquay, this is Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye on 94.7 The Pulse.
28 minutes after 10 o'clock, we're down here at the Torquay RSL and Bowls Club as part of our commemorative Anzac Day broadcast. It's been an incredible day so far. We've spoken to some pretty interesting people, and the two-up that was in front of us is now wrapped up, and I'm told the house made $300 or that amount, and that money is now going to the Torquay RSL, so all to a good cause, even if that is the losings, I suppose. Some people that were trying to make a bit of extra money but didn't quite get there. That's all right. James Taylor's on the line from the Surf Coast Times newspaper. He's a senior journalist there. How are you, James?
Good morning, Mitchell. How are you? Hopefully you stayed dry over the wild weather we had last night.
Well, we just did, but the bowling greens here at the Torquay Bowls Club, one of them looks like a swimming pool at the moment.
Yeah, I can imagine there's not going to be any Anzac Day bowls today, although it's good to hear the two-up look well.
Absolutely. Now, tell us about the dawn service. From what I understand, you were covering that for the paper?
Yes, I was. I was there taking probably more notes than pictures, given the weather. It was probably a smaller service than previous years, especially smaller than the Bunter 2015 edition. But still a very, very, very moving and very interesting service, as this year's edition of the Anzac Day services was honouring the achievements of the Australian Live Horse, which I suppose some of your listeners will be familiar from their famous exploits in the Battle of Bashiba, example, in World War One. The guest speaker was Lieutenant Colonel Graham Smith, who's retired from the Light Horse, and in his civilian life, he's a chartered accountant, and he lives with his wife, Louise, in Clifton Springs. But essentially, filled in the details about some of the notable figures of the Light Horse in World War One, and how they really weren't. They really weren't seeking glory at the time, and their method of warfare, I suppose, never will be seen again, given the way that horses are no longer a regular part of the armies that you might see around the world.
Yeah, and just describe what the rain did, I suppose, to the numbers. You said it was slightly smaller than usual. I heard that normally you'd expect about 15,000 people there. Is that right?
Yeah, sort of up to 15. 15 is kind of beginning bigger and bigger every year, so 15 is sort of becoming sort of an average. But I would say numbers were down probably by at least a third. Just that's purely based on traffic, both coming in and coming out. It was pretty easy to get in. I ended up getting a park pretty close to Point Dancer. That should give you some indication about the lesser cars that were there. Mm. But I'd say maybe. Maybe 10,000. It's always hard to tell. It's always hard to tell crowd numbers, especially given I was right up front.
Yeah.
I certainly wasn't standing back with a canning head. But yeah, numbers certainly down. Probably affected by the weather.
Yeah, and from what I understand, they had a park and ride service, didn't they? So people didn't have to park right there, and they could still not have to walk too far. Was that in use?
Yeah, that's all right. That's something the Shire has introduced in the past couple of years. Just to stop the sheer traffic snarl from people trying to park in the surrounding streets. They opened up Spring Creek Reserve and let people park their cars in there and then run shuttle buses from there to Point Danger before the service and then in reverse on the way back. And it seems to work pretty well. I think in the first couple of years, especially that 1950, that 2015 one, where it was absolutely huge, the park and ride service ended up having to close because the Spring Creek car park had to be shut. They filled up that quickly. As far as I know, they haven't had any issues with it this time. But it's a good idea in terms of putting on the people in a centralised location, somewhere that's secure, somewhere that's well lit, somewhere that's not going to be terribly affected by the weather, and getting them all shuttled to and from the service. Great idea. Keep it going.
We had the mayor on the program earlier, and I asked him, of course, about the Geelong Dawn service down by the water.
Yes.
And he thinks that the two can coexist because obviously the Torquay one is getting bigger and bigger, and there's only a limited number of people it can host. Is that the prevailing view, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's one of those things that I don't think you're ever going to take away the, for lack of a better word, the atmosphere of the Point Danger service, because there's just something particular about standing out on that headland, hearing the waves crash and watching the sunrise come up. I don't think there's anywhere else in Victoria that can kind of match that atmosphere, other than possibly the Shrine of Remembrance itself. But there probably is room for another Anzac service in Geelong for people who don't want to make the trek all the way down here. So yeah, I think they can probably both coexist. We'll have to give it a couple of years and see what happens. I mean, I wouldn't go as far to say that numbers at Torquay had been cut in half because there's a service in Geelong and everyone went there. Yeah, that certainly wasn't the case. It probably did attract a few more people that otherwise would have travelled to Torquay. But let's wait to see how things wash up at the end.
It was probably a bit harder to work out, I suppose, what the effect of numbers would be, given that this year there was so much wet weather that sort of already put a dampener on numbers, so to speak.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who'd like to pay their respects if they woke up this morning and after enduring a very soggy night last night. Hopefully their houses didn't get flooded and looked outside and it's still raining, thinking, well, I'm not sure if I want to be standing in the rain for the better part of 2 hours.
And it may not even be in the rain itself. Like, I know that there's been issues of flash flooding and even driving down to Torquay this morning, just looking along the sides of roads, again, looking like swimming pools. So people may be like, you know, I don't want to drive through flood waters if that was an issue cutting them off. I'm not sure what the extent of the damage was. I don't know if you've been following that, of course, for the paper.
Yeah, I've been having a look around, and just from my own observations, driving there and driving back, certainly a lot of water on the road. As I drove there, on the way back, there was a bit of an incident just short of the Mountainy roundabout, the Surf Coast Highway. So I took a quick detour down Van Dickens Road, and there was plenty of water flowing along the sides of the roads there. Thompson's Creek was well and truly up. Usually, you don't even notice Thompson's Creek as you head over the bridge as you're driving towards Torquay or driving back towards Geelong, but it was well and truly up this time, and plenty of water flowing down the sides of the roads, and in some cases over the roads on the dirt and gravel roads in the back parts of the Surf Coast Shire. So nothing too severe as far as I can see. And let's hope that people heed the oft-repeated warning from the SES and the police and the CFA of not driving through floodwater no matter where you sit.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it seems ridiculous to me that we have to repeat this every single time and time and time again on broadcasts like this. But then there's always some video that surfaces on social media of someone that's tried to get through floodwater and has failed and written off their car. So it's like, well, we just have to keep repeating it.
Exactly. It actually reminds me a little bit of that long-running campaign from the Torquay police asking people to, it seems obvious, but to lock their cars and lock their houses.
Yeah, that's it. Now, on another issue that I asked the mayor about this morning, there's been a little bit of debate between councils, which is good. That's why we have a council, on displaying a rainbow flag. And from what I understand, this is going to be discussed at tomorrow night's meeting?
That's right, it is. This is something the Shire has made a couple of moves in recent times to support marriage equality and lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights, essentially. I think this has largely been pushed by Rose Hodge. I think she's a huge supporter of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I know that the Shire's Ida Hot our celebrations have been getting bigger and bigger over the past couple of years. The motion tonight is for the Shire to fly the rainbow flag continually from the 17th of May, which is Ida Hot Day, until formal acceptance of marriage equality by the federal government. Now, given the way that the negotiations on marriage equality have essentially stalled in federal parliament at the moment, that could be a very long time. Now, this had she been there at the time, this would have been opposed by Councillor Heather Wellington, who I think is on personal leave at the moment, but she sent an open letter to, I think, a few of the media organisations around town, including us, essentially saying that she supports marriage equality and she's totally in favour of people being able to make commitments to each other regardless of being their sex and their gender. But she's taking issue with it about, and I'm quoting directly from her letter, she's quite certain the vast majority of people that voted in the 2016 election did not anticipate the people that they elected would use their privileged positions to promulgate personal views about social issues that fall within the mandate of the federal government and have no relevant relationship at all to our local government districts or our defined areas of responsibility under the Local Government Act. Now this isn't the first time that Heather Wellington has made noise on the floor of council about things that are and things that are not core council business. This is a bit of a personal favourite of hers in terms of the things that she's interested in. She's very keen for the council to focus on things that fall in its wheelhouse, if you like. And while she might be supportive of individual motions that council might make, if it's falling outside what's inside the Local Government Act, she's not in favour of it.
I think she has a fair point, to be quite honest. I mean, Rose Hodge is obviously a tireless campaigner on this issue, and I don't doubt that what she's trying to do is very genuine. I suppose it's one thing to put the flag up for Idaho Week, but another thing to say we're going to keep it up there until same-sex marriage is legal in Australia, which, as you've pointed out, given the current federal political climate, could be a long way away, possibly, or probably, I would say, after the next election at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that might well end up coming around. Things have sort of ground to hold at the moment, but it might well be the case that the campaign for marriage equality gets all the horses together and sort of comes back with a vengeance in the new year, as I think they mentioned that they might do when they were down in Torquay earlier this year. Torquay, well, if nothing happens in terms of the vote, well, then we're going to start individually targeting people that say they're in favour of marriage equality in the coalition. We've got to conclude Sarah Henderson and saying these people aren't doing their job as representatives of the government. So that's certainly a federal issue, and I think there's probably a lot of local support for that sort of thing, which is why that marriage equality meeting got such a decent turnout when it was held at the Australian National Surfing Museum. But you can also see Heather's point as well. This is it's not something that people campaigned on, as far as I'm aware. It's not something that sort of individual marriage rights isn't core council business. So it'll be interesting to see how the councillors actually vote on it. I mean, this all comes to a vote tomorrow night. Whether this is going a bit too far, or whether it's a view that's held by a majority of councils, I'm honestly not sure. We will have to see.
One thing I think is interesting is the mayor Brian McKittrick. He's quite willing to be impartial, I suppose. He wasn't giving up his point of view. You won't know, apparently, until he actually goes and votes. Is that sort of how mayors have traditionally been in this area in the past? Because I know in other municipalities, the mayor is quite often not backwards in coming forwards, and Darren Lyons is obviously someone we all remember as being very open with his views, and Councillor McKitterick is, I suppose, trying to facilitate a bit more debate and not hijack it with his own personal view.
That's true, yeah. I think it depends on the municipality, and I think it depends on the mayor. You mentioned Darren Lyons. In my previous journalistic career, I covered the city of Casey in the eastern part of Melbourne, and Sam Aziz, who I think is still the mayor down there, was very forward on some issues when he was the mayor, and not at all reticent about coming forward and making his view not as just a councillor, but as the head of the local government. So I think it really depends. Brian's probably of a similar mind to me, and that he's not quite sure how everyone's going to vote at this point. I mean, it's one of those things that it might not have been widely discussed yet. As I understand, this has entered the council agenda as an urgent business or a petition or a notice of motion. So it might not have been something that has been given a lot of notice to all of the councillors. So perhaps most of the debate on the issue might actually happen on the council floor on a Wednesday night.
Yeah, we don't want to sort of preempt that process that you'll obviously go through. But my personal view is I think it's probably going to end up getting passed, just because people like to say that they're in support of this sort of thing, and this is a good way to show their support. And they think probably, and they're possibly right, that down this way, I think the Idaho cause has a lot of support among constituents, and people will want to show their constituents that they're doing something about it, and this is probably a very straightforward way to do it. So in my personal view, just sort of gut instinct, I've got a feeling that the flag will probably be flying, but who knows? We'll have to wait and see.
Exactly, we certainly will.
Yeah. Now, there's been a few other things happening down this way. I suppose one other interesting thing for me is the budget. I mean, this gets a lot of people talking every single time it happens. Rate capping has played an interesting role in that. I guess there's less talk now about whether rates will go up or not. We sort of know. What do you think is happening?
Yeah, I think council, I think the Surf Coast specifically, and maybe councils generally, as I think was the intention of rate capping, have seen the introduction of limiting rate rises to a certain percentage each year as kind of an opportunity to really look at their organisations and really not so much tighten the belt, but see if they can do things better and go through the organisation and restructure and say, okay, well, these are things that people definitely want. These are things we can do better. These are things we can probably outsource to other people. So that's certainly a view put forward by Surfco Shire CEO Keith Bailey, who has been driving a lot of business reorganisation and efficiency drives inside the Surfco Shire, and then committed money in the budget to that purpose. to essentially go right through and find out things they can tighten up and things they can do better. And it seems to be proving results, given that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a ratepayer here, obviously.
Yes.
But I just find it interesting when he says, you know, we're trying to, this is Brian McKittrick, when he says we're trying to find better ways of doing things. I mean, that sounds like a great initiative, great as a ratepayer, but you sort of wonder, well, why weren't they doing that before? Why does it take rate capping to make people actually become more efficient with ratepayers' money? At least that's what I'm feeling.
Yeah, this is a common argument when it comes to rate paying. So to rate capping, it's all very well to sort of have organisations get better at what they're doing, but sometimes you need the stick to come in over the top and force government to do it. I know it's a common criticism of the Servco Shire about being one of the more higher rating councils in Victoria. But rates are really one of the only levers they have to pull. So it may have been the case that they may not have had the luxury of having to look around and seeing where they were perhaps a little bit bloated and a little bit overcapitalized in certain areas until they were forced to.
Well, James, thanks for being with us this morning and giving up your Anzac Day off. We appreciate it. We'll catch up with you in a fortnight.
No problem. Thanks very much, Mitchell.
Thank you, James Taylor there from the Surf Coast Times newspaper, senior journalist there.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye, Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.